The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, a bullet from Firmino and Spurs' resistance to take Liverpool top. But who deserved it? The team that attacked a lot or the team that attacked very occasionally? How good is Curtis Jones? Feels about the right time to start really building him up. Good news, everybody. Big Sam is back. He's never been relegated from the Premier League. Are West Brom now safe? And would Sam have got the Arsenal job if he'd hung around for another week or two? They have another man sent off as Theo Walcott scores and celebrates at the Emirates. Everton are good again. Leeds are still fun. Chelsea can't beat anyone good, and Christian Benteke and Sebastian Haller score in the same game. Rangers lose, French football's in crisis, what Brexit means for football, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Philippe Auclair, bonjour, ça va?
Salutes you, Max.
Ça va bien. The founder and editor of Just Football and from the Nordic Football Pod, Jonathan Faduba is back. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, Max. Hi, guys. Nice to see you all. Thanks for having me on.
Barry Glendenning, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Max.
Now, before the pod, before we started recording, Barry, I presumed everyone would say Liverpool totally deserved this win over Tottenham, but you're not so sure.
I do, in so far as, and I may well be blinded by my fabled love for the man, but he said after the game that he thought the better team lost, and I think he had a point. He went to the Anfield with a plan. It almost worked, despite having 75% possession or thereabouts. Liverpool were largely restricted to long range shots, which didn't trouble Lloris at all, and they relied on a fluke deflection and a set piece goal to win. They didn't create many chances from open play. Spurs, by contrast, scored an excellent goal on the break, created, I would say, three excellent chances not too long after half-time, and those chances, failed to convert those chances. That wasn't Jose Mourinho's fault. It wasn't Jose Mourinho's fault that Bobby Firmino got a free header at the corner to score Liverpool's winner. So I think it was two excellent teams going about their business in very different ways. Liverpool had luck and Spurs didn't. So I didn't think it was ridiculous that he thought the best team lost. I've thought it ridiculous in the past when he said the same thing, but not on this occasion.
Philippe, agree, disagree with Barry?
Well, I think the astonishing thing is that I think Barry has put a little bit of water in his wine between the pre-pod talk, in which he was actually quite sanguine about Jose Mourinho, and is much more, how can I put it? Yes, is perhaps his more considered view, but because I don't disagree with what Barry was saying. I thought Tottenham were absolutely was superb. It's one of the best games I've seen them play in that kind of situation. They were fantastic against Manchester City, but City were not quite the same kind of opponent as what we saw from Liverpool last night. On the other hand, the one thing I would disagree is the fact that actually Liverpool did create quite a number of chances in the first half in particular. There was one in particular for Mohamed Salah, which didn't test Lloris when he really should have. But I don't think it's completely scandalous for to say that, yes, the marginally better team on the evening won. Was not a great triumph. It was not written in the stars. And it took a very, very special goal from Bobby Firmino and a moment of a strange moment of mindlessness in the Tottenham defence to leave him with this amount of space. Was it Kane, by the way, who forgot about him? I don't know. Maybe it was. Because he had so much...
It looked a bit like Kane. Yeah. And Eric Dier went down and complained, but I don't think that was connected to, you know, I suppose Kane, look, has two moments in the penalty area, doesn't he? That header that he misses.
Yeah.
And he's, then not following Firmino.
He's so rubbish, isn't he? I mean, he's... But it's certainly the best game we've seen since the beginning of the season, I believe, without a doubt. And confirmation of, I think, as Klopp said after the game, that Tottenham will be there or thereabouts at the end of the season, because you can't see them. This is actually a defeat from which Mourinho will take an awful lot of encouragement, whatever he thinks about the fairness of the result or not.
Jonathan, it was a brilliant header from Firmino. And he's had a lot of criticism recently. And I don't know if that's you know, criticism from people that want him to score 25 goals a season, because he's not that kind of player, Brian, is he? You know, he's a lovely footballer, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a really good player, and probably this was his moment. You could see the celebration that he had at the end. He ran. It was quite a strange celebration because he ran sort of towards the bench, but then you sort of expected Klopp to run onto the pitch or something and grab him, but no one from the bench came to see him, so he sort of just stopped and just looked towards the bench and then turned around again. So it was, if you watch the celebration back, it's a bit of a strange one. I don't know who he was running to, like sort of a scene of a film or something.
I thought he was going to the cop. And then just thought, actually, it's quite a long way away.
Sort of had it by your celebration, and then it was like, actually, this is quite tiring. And so sort of turned around. But yeah, he's a quality player. He plays a role that, funnily enough, I think sort of Spurs are trying to kind of do a bit with Harry Kane, in the sense of Jose Mourinho's come in and kind of turned Kane from an out-and-out striker to a player who comes more deep and, plays passes through to the likes of Son, similar to the way that Firmino can do so for Mo Salah and Sadio Mane. So I think there are some parallels in the forward lines of what Spurs are trying to do and what Liverpool have done for quite a few years. You could see at the end, obviously, Mourinho was quite sort of pig sick in his interview, and obviously mentioned to Klopp at the end, didn't he, saying that he got lucky and that kind of thing. And then he also came out with the comments saying that, you know, the things that Klopp gets away with on the touchline, he would never be able to dream of doing. And I think that reflects just how disappointed he was, because there was an opportunity there for Spurs to grab something, I think.
One thing I would add is the fact, and I'm sure we're going to mention Curtis Jones, but the fact is that the performance that Liverpool gave, especially in the first half, they were truly wonderful to watch. We've got to remember, and actually I pinch myself a little bit, that they're giving this kind of performance without their most informed player, who was Diogo Jota, who is currently injured. They're doing it without their emblematic captain, Virgil van Dijk. And they're doing it without the guy who was supposed and who will transform the way they play and make them able actually to perhaps play better against teams which are very packed at the back, i.e. Thiago Alcantara. So three major players missing. And there are probably others I forget about. Trent Alexander-Arnold just coming back from injury. And they still managed to produce this quite exceptional football. I think bodes extremely well beyond the result for Liverpool. I think because of that, you can say that they have restated their claim that it's very likely that they will be the champions in 2021. Because to be honest, I really wasn't expecting this kind of quality for Liverpool with all these players missing and everything that's been happening to them as well. I mean, the number of games and so forth, but they were tremendous. And they've got Curtis Jones now as well.
Yeah. Before we do Curtis Jones, Mag says, can you please talk about Tim Sherwood's spectacular commentary on the build-up to Firmino's winner? Amazon were doing kind of what the goals show do, on BT. So they're showing each goal as it goes in, and they're talking about the action. They're cutting to games live. And as the Liverpool corner's being taken, Tim Sherwood says, I'm not too worried about this corner. It might come back to bite me here, but I think Tottenham have got the dominancy in the air, you know. So I'm not sure anyone can get the head on the ball first for Liverpool, apart from that one. As the ball just sails into the top corner.
When I said before the pod that I thought I agreed with Jose, I thought the better team lost. You seemed quite scornful of the opinion. But if Liverpool had 75% of possession and played as imperiously as everyone or their fans certainly say they did, why did they rely on a header at a set piece and a fluke deflection to win the game? That's, you know, I thought they played
I thought Tottenham's defence in this game was much more last gasp to me, and it felt more like Liverpool just have that ability in tight areas and the ability to go long as well as go short, so they can stretch with sort of Mane and Salah as well as you know, play beautiful little triangles. And I just felt maybe, you know, when you play Liverpool, of course, some of your defence will be last gasp. It felt more, as someone who watches with a very Tottenham head on, watches these games, I felt much more like Liverpool were going to break it down more than City or Arsenal. But maybe that is just revisionism because Tottenham lost that game.
I think it also speaks to how influential Heung-min Son has become. He's really the main, most clinical player now to a certain extent. I mean, if you look at his shot accuracy this season, it's 78% against Kane's 49%. And, you know, when Son had that one chance, he sort of buried it, didn't he? And, he's, you know, joint top scorer in the Premier League now, along with Salah and Dominic Calvert-Lewin. So I think it really spoke to how effective Son has become as a goal scorer. Whereas obviously Bergwijn was a little bit more rusty, like you say, and Kane hasn't quite been, you know, his goal conversion accuracy is 23% this season, Son 61%. So that just speaks a little bit about the differences in how clinical the two have been in front of goal this season.
Mark says, have you ever considered doing a John Terry floor header scale, a classic one from Højbjerg tonight? Nothing makes me happier than seeing a player stretching for a ball, make a tackle and then fall. And then the only thing they can do is just sort of waft their head at a ball that's on the floor. But Højbjerg did that. It wasn't enough. They still lost. Now, Philippe, yes.
Two quick things. The first thing is about Curtis Jones, seeing how he's progressing by leaps and bounds, when at one point I thought he was the only one who thought, really believed he could progress by leaps and bounds and came out as a little bit cocky, shall we say. But obviously he's got the quality to back it up. But this emergence makes me understand a bit better why Liverpool seem to be so relaxed about the Gini Wijnaldum situation. Because you were thinking, you know, how can you think you've got Wijnaldum is only, what now, 7 months away from the end of his contract, 6 months and a half away from the end of his contract. Nothing has been signed, nothing has been agreed. You think, wow, that's leaving it very late. You should be worried about it. But they obviously think, actually, we've got a few solutions, you know. And I think Curtis Jones is part of this solution. So, yes, just a little grain of salt I wanted to add to the stew, my dear Max.
Also, just if I could quickly, as someone who covers non-league like extensively, I just want to give a bit of a shout out to Reece Williams, because I found that to be an incredible performance for a 19-year-old on his Premier League debut. And I think it really speaks to the quality in the lower leagues, potentially, and the young players that there are that get that experience. Because, you know, the last season, Reece Williams was playing for Kidderminster Harriers in the National League North. So for him to sort of come in and step in against, you know, Harry Kane and be so composed and have such a good game, I thought was a real testament to, you know, the depth of quality in England's lower leagues as well. You know, that's an incredible jump, isn't it, from Kidderminster to playing in the Premier League,
yeah,
such a big game.
That's mad. Philippe, while we're on Liverpool, you were friends with Gerard Houllier. We paid tribute to him sort of briefly on Monday, but I'm sure you'd like to say something about him.
I don't know, Max. I suppose so. It feels still very unreal. It's the first time that somebody whom I who is or was a friend, I see his face every day in the papers. It's a very odd thing, and which I find very difficult to cope to deal with, I must say. But what one thing that because I've spoken to a lot of his friends over the last few days, as you can imagine, and I spoke with Michael Owen yesterday about Gerard, and it's more than affection. I mean, the utter love that this man obviously managed to inspire in so many people, be they players or fans or journalists, actually got it on very well with our lot. Is something that, you know, is quite extraordinary. And I'm not betraying Owen's confidence, because it is something that we did for France Football. And he said, I only hope that when the time for me comes to join Gerard, people will talk about me as they are talking about him right now. And I think, you know, you've basically said it all. I mean, we're missing, it's the man that we're going to miss an awful lot, as well as the wonderful technician. But it's the smile, it's the presence, it's the love and the affection of that man. He was really very, very special, Max, I can tell you that. Very special man.
Thanks, Philippe. Let's move on to the return of Sam Allardyce. I mean, West Brom drew at Manchester City. The game itself we'll get onto briefly in a second, but Bilic has been sacked. I mean, and Big Sam's come in. I don't know exactly, Barry, what the board were expecting from Slaven Bilic.
I think they were expecting him to not be in the relegation zone after, 12, 13 games of the season. He was working with one hand tied behind his back, having been given very few funds. I think he only got 25 million to bolster his squad after securing promotion. And a promotion I think he didn't get enough credit for, possibly because people saw it as West Brom winning by default through Brentford's inability to take any of the three chances they had to go up automatically by winning one of their last three games of the season. He didn't seem to get on with the club hierarchy. He, by all accounts, was on the verge of resigning in November. And it's not really a surprise to see him go. And West Brom have, the hierarchy have nailed their colours to the mast now and stated their ambition, which is we want to stay up. Slaven Bilic will get another job. He leaves with a good payout. Everyone likes him. He'll be fine. I think he's possibly better off.
Because it's Christmas, have a couple of months off. And
well, I don't think he was happy there. And he didn't get on with his bosses. And I presume football is no different to any job. If you're unhappy and you don't get on with your bosses and someone says, here's a huge bag of money to fuck off, and take it. And if you're guaranteed another job in the future, which he will be, yeah, why not?
Jonathan, you're young. How do the young people view Sam Allardyce?
I think I'm a little bit different in my views of Sam Allardyce, to be honest, compared to a lot of people. Over the years, I've always felt he's a, well, apart from the pints of wine and the, you know, secret cameras, I've always felt he's a little bit misrepresented, to be honest. I think he's really done quite a good job at a lot of clubs over the years. There's been certain clubs where maybe it didn't work out quite so well, Everton for a while. But I think, you know, he always gets talked about for that. If I was called Aladici, I'd be at Real Madrid comment, doesn't he? He always gets sort of called out for that. But I do actually think that the achievements he has done, for example, at Bolton, where he got them into Europe, you know, now when you think about Bolton Wanderers in Europe, it's almost like a fantasy kind of thing when you think about where they are today. I do think that there was a sort of crumb of a point there, really, to a certain extent. I know he did eventually get the England job, of course, but I think the point he was essentially making, and I think there is a wider debate to be had there, is kind of like, what is the ceiling for the English manager to a certain extent? Because if you take Bolton into the UEFA Cup, or, you know, at the time, as he did, and some of the achievements he had, you would think that maybe he'd be in for a top job, and he never really was. And I think kind of, I suppose, if you look at the parallels with someone like Mikel Arteta at Arsenal, he went straight into a top job as he did. I think there's probably that feeling from Allardyce that kind of he's, you know, he feels that he would never have got that role. And I do think there's a conversation to be had even now, because managers like Sean Dyche, who's done a fantastic job as well at Burnley, just overachieving with them for so long, and even maybe Chris Wilder, although it's gone a little bit pear-shaped this season. What is that ceiling for those English managers? And I think he does open up a wider conversation that I think sometimes isn't really sort of talked about. He kind of just got rubbished and ridiculed, didn't he? And I'm pretty sure he'll keep West Brom up, and, you know, it won't be very much fun probably for the fans to watch at times, but there were a lot of things that Allardyce did quite well, bringing in Prozone, things like that. So he, although he's a kind of a pint of wine drinking, you know, he's portrayed in that way. I do think there's a little bit more to him in that sense.
Yeah.
And he's a little bit more innovative than maybe he's sometimes portrayed.
I suppose the ceiling is the England job, isn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, he did have it a bit. Johnny Liu writing, Philippe, indeed, on some level, it's surprising that Allardyce hasn't already managed West Brom at some point. Oh, you're right. I was convinced he'd done it about five times. In the same way, you occasionally need reminding that James McArthur never actually played for Everton. Again, that surprised me once Johnny Liu put it on paper.
Well, Allardyce's first job in management was with West Brom. He was appointed first team coach or reserve team coach or something back. And then he left and went to Limerick City, which is where his odyssey began officially.
Is that right? Did he get a lot from Gaelic football?
Limerick City is not a Gaelic football.
My apologies to Ireland there.
I attended a game at Limerick City once as a Shamrock Rovers fan and got chased by youths on horseback.
On horseback? Wow. How medieval.
Yes.
What had you done? Had you stolen a loaf of bread?
Oh, I was a Shamrock Rovers fan.
Oh, I see. Philippe?
Yes, I mean, several things about Allardyce. As for Stephen Billich's situation, I'm with Barry. I don't think he didn't look distraught when he was talked to about the possibility of his dismissal. He just basically shrugged his shoulders. And as Barry said, he will find another job and probably a better one than the one he'd been handed at West Brom. But when it comes to Allardyce, I mean, there's some... I think this glass ceiling thing is a bit of is a myth. You know, or maybe in this case, Frank Lampard is not an English manager. You know, there is nothing more bizarre about Allardyce not being at Arsenal, which he could never be, because if he came to Arsenal, he probably would be tarred and feathered and then dropped in, you know, the river at some point. But this glass ceiling thing is a complete myth. It's ridiculous. Because you say English, but some British managers got some very big jobs in the recent past. That some of them have made a pig's arse or pig's breakfast or whatever out of it is a completely different matter. David Moyes had Manchester United, for Christ's sake. I mean, and he's part of this group of players who are on this strange merry-go-round of which to be ejected. You know, I don't know. It's like gravity. It's like this old thing you had in fairgrounds, you know, when you go inside this kind of drum and it rotates very quickly and you're stuck to the wall. And these guys, he's one of them. And it's
getting on that fairground ride and just lying back against that thing and looking around, and there's Roy Hodgson, David Moyes, and Sam
Hodgson,
Allardyce next
Roy
to
Hodgson
you.
Doesn't belong in that group at all. Roy Hodgson is a different category. Okay. Roy Hodgson's career was out of England for the greatest part of his life, so it's completely different. Fine. But
he's on the Dodgins. He's not on the fairground ride.
But that's one thing.
Yeah, he's the guy who stands on the back of the Dodgin with a roll-up cigarette hanging out the back of his mouth, chatting up your girlfriend.
God, that is not...
And you can see her taking a shine to him because he's a bit of rough. A bit of carny rough.
That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll start Ellen Road. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Leeds 5, Newcastle 2. Stuart says, a lovely evening for Newcastle fans tonight, one might suggest, after getting the defeat that they would want. Painter says, has there ever been a more engaging side in the Premier League that will likely not even challenge for a European place than Bielsa's Leeds? As a supporter with recency bias, I'm enjoying this more than the Champions League semi-final season. Philippe, you loved Rodrigo's header to make it 2-1. How to define this header? A power glancing header? What is it?
I think what I like is that, I mean, you know, they talk about high energy football. I get the feeling that Leeds players, they whack the ball harder than anybody else. I don't know. I get that feeling. And it's the Harrison cross that really got me go, oh, my God, I love this. And the beautiful correspondence that you had between this cross, which was volleyed with maximum velocity, and that bullet header. I mean, the ball was traveling at the speed of light. There was a massive boom over Elland Road when the ball went into the... I don't know. It encapsulated for me what has been so thrilling about this side is this abandon, I would say, with which Leeds are playing their football. And again, they give absolutely everything. When they hit the ball, my goodness. You know, they say it stays hit. Well, the ball stays hit for 90 minutes with Bielsa's Leeds.
That goal was also the completion of a 1-2. Because it was a Rodrigo who played the ball to Harrison in the first place. It was unbelievable.
And Harrison's goal at the end as well. I mean, that is just what a hit that is, Jonathan. I mean, they're just so much fun.
They're really a strange team as well because, I mean, for anyone who's likes the data and the statistics side of it, Leeds are top of the XG charts by miles, expected goals. They're actually well clear of teams like Liverpool, but obviously not quite translating it as many goals as Liverpool have scored. But they're top of the XG and then they're bottom of the league for expected goals against. So they're expected to... Essentially, they've been expected to score the most amount of goals and concede the most amount of goals. So, you know, I've got a very close friend who's a Leeds fan, and you don't know whether he's going to... He feels as if almost they could win the league, but also get relegated. It's like, you just don't know what to expect with his team. And I think that's just... that's what football's all about, really, isn't it? They're a breath of fresh air, I think, and a fantastic, entertaining side.
Now, Matt says Leeds' fourth goal against Newcastle. Has any goal ever looked more like a spectacularly one-sided playground game of British Bulldog? I mean, that actually, British Bulldog is a really good way of describing what Leeds United are doing. I mean, Philippe, can you think why more teams don't do that? Like, we all love seeing that, but, you know, it doesn't get you any. You know, I don't want to say Bielsa's a myth. Let's be clear about this. But it gets you loved, and maybe love is more important.
Well, it certainly is very important, but you threw me a curveball here, and I don't know how to hit it. I've missed it. Yes, there's Bielsa. There's only one Bielsa. What can I say? Because it's been the same everywhere he's gone. People will ask you exactly the same question in France when you saw his Marseille team. When you saw it, when you saw Marseille today with Villas-Boas, and you compare to what it was with Bielsa, my goodness, the two different universes. Doesn't mean that Marseille, that Villas-Boas' Marseille is not doing well in some respects. But no, I have no answer to that. It's, well, apart from the obvious, it's this one guy who doesn't even speak the language that most of his players speak and who manages to make them play like that.
Scott says, if Bielsa's the greatest coach ever, why doesn't he ask his players to defend corners? I mean, it's not a daft question, is it? A stat from Johnny Cooper. This is the third time that Leeds are heading into a league game against Manchester United after scoring five goals in the previous match. The previous three, well, there's this one, December 2020. December 1966, they beat Newcastle 5-0. December 1929, they beat Newcastle 5-2. And Pablo Hernandez, the oldest player to assist twice in a Premier League game for Leeds, 35 years and 249 days, since who? Does anybody want to guess?
David Batty.
No. Gordon Strachan in November 1993, who was 36. I mean, I think Hernandez's second assist, where he passed it to Harrison about 400 miles from the goal. That doesn't seem to me... That's a bit like Steve Lomas, who claims an assist for that Kincladze goal for Manchester City, because he just played a five-yard pass to him before Kincladze ran past everybody.
And the Argentinian dude who claims the assist for Maradona's goal of the century.
To the Emirates then, Arsenal 1, Southampton 1. Neil, how soon after the pod finishes recording will Arteta get sacked? John, should Big Sam have waited a week or two for the Arsenal job? Nick Harris at Sporting Intel saying, look, Arsenal being pleased with a point at home to Southampton, who've never won away at Arsenal in the Premier League, tells you everything about Arsenal's season. Saints been hugely disappointed at not winning away against 10-man Arsenal, says much about theirs. Like, Arsenal were bad in that first half, Philippe. I was reading a lot of people saying Arteta's got 45 minutes to save his job. Do you think he did have that? And if he did, or do you think that's all nonsense?
I think it's a lot of nonsense. I don't think the problems start and finish with Arteta. And I actually, he's part of the problem, but not because he wants to be or because he should be. Every Arsenal fan will have a sensation of déjà vu, what's happening with Mikel Arteta at the moment. It reminds me very much of the situation about a month and a half before Unai Emery was sacked. And I remember this very, very clearly because actually Arsenal had started the season in a reasonable fashion. And they were on the back of a European final, by the way. So they were not that bad. But the thing is that the speed at which things deteriorated was absolutely extraordinary. And it was due partly to the personality of Unai Emery and the fact he didn't get on with some of the players. And what I can see with some of the fans is them taking the same point of view. It's like completely forgetting about the fact Arsenal won the FA Cup on the 1st of August, which is not that long time ago, that everybody was super excited to see Thomas Partey, who is injured, becoming an Arsenal player. And you can carry on like that. And you think, well, there's an awful lot of this which is self-inflicted. And I can understand why it didn't work in the case of Unai Emery. In the case of Mikel Arteta, it would be completely crazy. The situation of the club at the moment is not of his doing. The club is... Arsenal are paying for the Mesut Ozil situation in a big, big way, which Arteta really doesn't have much of a say in. We'll see what happens in January. Are there alternatives? I don't think so. Can he pull this round? I think so too. And one of the reasons being actually this performance against Southampton, a Southampton team which would have gone top of the league if it had won at the Emirates. So I think, you know, comparing it to the Southampton of the good old days, which finished, you know, on 12th position on, in a good year, is a little bit beside the point here. It's a very, very fine Southampton side. And it's an Arsenal side which is suffering, which is literally suffering in its flesh with players who are out of confidence and so forth. But there was some kind of reaction. And I think that as well, the changes that, that Arteta did in the team, the players he took out and the players he brought in, are a sign that he might actually be on the right path for that. So I don't, I want to sound Mr. Optimistic for Arsenal Football Club. But I mean, what is being said is way over the top. Way over the top.
Jonathan, how pleased were you that Theo Walcott scored at the Emirates?
No, I was happy for him. I think he probably was conflicted in terms of his celebration and the fact that there was no fans there. So it was kind of a weird sort of, do I not celebrate in front of no fans, or do I celebrate in front of no fans but TV cameras? Kind of like an internal debate he was having with himself, maybe. I mean, I think he was totally right to celebrate. The criticism he got from some quarters was a bit over the top, I thought. It was just arms out, wasn't it? It wasn't really like a, he didn't run to a camera and sort of point, you know, with his finger over his lips or anything like that. So it wasn't,
no.
It was fine, you know. And yeah, it always seems to happen, doesn't it? Players against their former clubs.
I think Arsenal got Everton next, so Iwobi will score in that game. Barry, what do you make of Arsenal's indiscipline? It seems to keep on happening. I mean, Gabriel's, so his first yellow was so ridiculous.
Well, that's what, 3 red cards they've had in a very short space of time, and all 3 of them were completely idiotic. So it clearly is a problem that Mikel Arteta needs to iron out. But these are things you shouldn't have to tell professional footballers. You know, don't grab an opponent round the throat. Don't do whatever it was Nicola Pepe did. I can't even remember now, but I do remember it was stupid.
And he headbutted the Leeds.
That was it.
But not
and,
really.
And
yeah.
Don't get 2 yellow cards for needlessly silly offences in quick succession. So if a manager has to go into that level of minutia and nitty-grittiness, it's small wonder he has not much time to coach them in the art of scoring goals. I mean, Barney made an interesting point on a Twitter feed. He said, you know, they need a steady hand on the tiller, they need people who can score goals, they need someone to unlock a defence. And then he posited that Arsene Wenger, Mesut Ozil, Olivier Giroud and Theo Walcott are all available should they wish to go and get them.
Wolves 2, Chelsea 1. I thought this was a great game of football. Why can't Chelsea beat anyone good, Jonathan?
It's a very good question, to be honest. I think they're still adapting to their new players. There's obviously question marks about Timo Werner at the moment and Kai Havertz, who looks as if probably will need some time to adapt to the English league. I know it's obviously a bit of a cliche, the intensity of the Premier League, that kind of thing. But Havertz is you know, a really young player, and he's been in a Leverkusen side where he was essentially, everything was built around him, to be honest. So he's having to adapt. I'm not sure if Lampard really knows what position to play Havertz in at the moment, because often he was used as a sort of forward for Leverkusen, sometimes as a false nine type thing. Whereas now he seems to be playing more in midfield, so there's questions there. It was a strange decision, sort of switching Timo Werner from one flank to the other. From one flank to the other at half time. Pulisic was doing really well on one side, and then Lampard switched him at half time, and that kind of changed things. They've got so many players as well. I think it's almost like they've made so many signings that fitting them in and getting any kind of set team is going to be a real challenge for them. You've still got players like, you know, Hudson-Odoi, who's maybe not getting in the team. Hakim Ziyech has still got injury problems, but they're going to have to integrate him somewhere in that team. There's a lot of players and a lot of things to work through, I think, with Chelsea, where they haven't really maybe just quite found exactly what they're going to do in terms of style and personnel.
And Wolves are finding a way without, I keep wanting to say Miguel Angel Jimenez. That's a, you know, I'm not sure how he would fit in the press for Wolves. Raul Jimenez. I'd like Miguel there with just a big cigar, just sort of on a golf buggy.
Doing his stretches with his driver, cigar in his
exactly,
mouth.
Exactly, yeah. And I thought they did really well in this game, Philippe.
They did very well indeed. I'm not too sure about the fact that they, you know, I think they feel the absence of Raúl Jiménez very, very badly, to be mm-hmm. honest. And the previous results were not great. And to be honest, and also you would have to feel the absence of, for me, the most complete number nine in the Premier League and one of the most complete number nines in the world in Raúl Jiménez is that good. But they're finding ways round it, and slowly, I was a little bit, to be honest, I was surprised by how poor Chelsea were. I mean, do I have a right to say that? Because I was expecting them to understand that Wolves are, it was coming on the back of some results which were disappointing ones, and precisely a team that had been rocked by, they've lost basically the two best strikers, one by selling him to Liverpool, and we've realized now that he was one of the best strikers that they had, and the second one to this terrible injury. And you thought, whoa, if I were Chelsea, I would try to exploit that. They looked a little bit, they were doubting themselves, which is not something you would associate with Wolves, and they failed to do that. So speaks a lot for the work that Nuno has been doing in terms of convincing them that they could do it. But I'm more, when I watched the game, I was more surprised by the relative feebleness of Chelsea than by the might of Wolves, if you see what I mean. I exaggerate. Feebleness is too strong a word, obviously. But they are way off where we would expect them to be, given... And I'm sorry, you know, well, don't talk about money, but you spent 250 million euros, mate, during the summer. No club.
They're only 6 points off the top, though. I mean, they're not a mile away.
They've bought players. I mean, Timo Werner is a player that many of Europe's greatest clubs, biggest clubs, wanted. Hakim Ziyech is a super player. Kai Havertz is the wonder kid of German football. You couldn't carry on like that. So they've made some very significant additions to their squad, but it's a very strange thing. It's a bit like Manchester United. Every time you think they're going up, next time they're going down. And Chelsea, there have been signs that, oh, you think, oh, he might have found a solution here, or they might have found a way to play, or it might, but no, the next one or the one after that, there is another problem. And I shouldn't go on about this, but for example, I'd like to understand how, with these players like Werner, Ziyech, Havertz, Lampard still plays with a target man, be it Abraham or Giroud. Now, I like Abraham and absolutely adore Olivier Giroud, as you know, Max. But I'm not sure that it really makes sense. It's like pieces from a different puzzle, in a way. I might be wrong. Maybe we'll find a way to make it all work together. But to me, it doesn't seem to be speaking to the qualities of the, Pulisic or you know, Werner and so forth, or Hudson-Odoi of these players. Does seem to me a bit ill-fitting.
Leicester 0, Everton 2. Back-to-back wins for Everton. Up into fifth place in the Premier League. Richarlison's so important for them. Barry, you and I don't know if we led the mocking of 40 million for Richarlison, but it sort of feels worth it now.
Yeah, I certainly thought they paid over the odds for him on the basis that he hadn't performed particularly well at Watford or in the build-up to when they bought him, and he seemed to be a bit of a troublemaker insofar as he was kind of down tools at Watford. And has their league position improved since they got him in? I don't think so. But then Everton has spent a lot of money on very expensive players without improving their league position. But if they sold them now, they would get more than 40 million. So I suppose it was worth it.
Mason Holgate got his first ever goal for Everton and celebrated like Tardelli for a tap-in. Jonathan, I don't know. I wondered if his celebration was too much considering how easy the goal it was that he scored, or should we accept it given that it was his first one?
I think, I suppose, for a defender, you don't get too many, do you? So you got to enjoy it. You got to enjoy it while it's there, and claim it as much as you can. So I think you're given the benefit of the doubt on that one.
Okay, I'm happy with that. Compared to Sebastian Haller, just before we get onto that, the Everton away kit deeply unpleasant. Christian Fuchs is still there at Leicester, Barry, just looking a bit tired of it all.
Well, I would imagine he's playing far more often than he was expecting to, or, to be honest, would like. I'm not sure if I've mentioned this before, but he was supposed to retire at the end of each of the last two seasons, and Leicester keep offering him a new contract. So he's basically being held captive against his will. What he wants to do is go and join his wife and kids in New York, where they live. He's got a football academy there that he's ready. I think, I'm not sure if it's open for business yet, but it's certainly ready to go. And he just wants a nice, cushy retirement. But Brendan Rodgers keeps making him play football matches. And he's quite old. And, you know, he's a lovely guy and he's a good player, but he's the weak link in that Leicester team. Other teams know this and keep targeting him, and I think it's very, very unfair.
There are videos of him going, Brendan Rodgers is treating me really well. I'm really happy here. West Ham 1, Crystal Palace 1. Two figures of fun scoring, and perhaps proving us all wrong. That Haller overhead kick, Jonathan. I mean, I gave it 8.2 on the Sinclair Spectrum because there's a bit of shin and there's no pace on the cross. But even still, it is a beautiful finish, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's quite strange because I think one of the last times I was on this podcast was when Danny Welbeck scored that overhead kick as well. So I suppose it bodes well for, you know, any sort of middling strikers at clubs beginning with W, if I'm ever appearing again. But, you know, you've got a good chance the night before to hit a beautiful overhead kick. So, yeah, there you go. It was very nice, though. Really nice. Really nice goal.
But, you know, as Matt says, imagine scoring a goal that good and not smiling. That's some broken heart right there, comparing it to Mason Holgate. I mean, imagine if Mason Holgate scored an overhead kick like that. That's the celebration that we really want to see. Lots of questions for you, Barry, on Christian Benteke. After Christian Benteke's return to form, is Barry predicting a fruitful summer for the striker at the Euros? Tom, do I back Benteke to finish top scorer in the Euros now, or shall I wait until the squad is announced? I mean, of all the things 2020 has thrown our way, is the most surprising and in-form Christian Benteke?
Well, I think Crystal Palace fans never lost faith in him. And even when he wasn't scoring, he was delivering the goods. And he's handy there as a sort of a giant wall in, standing in the penalty area for more nimble and skillful players to bounce the ball off and catch the return. I'm sure if you hang around there long enough, you're going to score eventually. I'm happy to see him scoring, but he doesn't seem hugely fussed. Maybe he's crying himself to sleep every night during his goal drought, but I have my doubts.
Fulham 0, Brighton 0. I enjoyed this tweet from Fulham centre-back Toysin Adarabayo, slightly pointed at his strikers. Every point is crucial to our fight, but being more clinical is a must. Happy to get a clean sheet today. The hard work continues. That reminds me so much of centre-backs at half-time in Sunday League going, why aren't we putting our chances away? I just love that. Clearly, he expected something more. It wasn't a terrible goalless draw, but it wasn't
It was a terrible goalless draw, Max.
Okay,
it was
fine.
A diabolical goalless draw. It was awful. A complete waste of everybody involved's time.
There we are. What a review of that football match. And that'll do for part two. We'll start part three with a very, very short Fit Bar Corner. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Duncan says, please give some airtime to my beloved St Mirren, ending Rangers' 27-game unbeaten run in the Cup. Definitely the best game in the UK last night. Barry, I don't know what your definition of some airtime is, but the floor is yours.
Well, I didn't see it. I was unaware of the outcome of this game until you texted me about 2 minutes before we were due to start.
20 minutes.
Yeah, I didn't see your text.
Okay.
I was toweling myself down after a shower, then I went to make some coffee.
Right.
So when I saw it, you gave me 2 minutes' notice. What I can tell you is St Mirren knocked Rangers out of the League Cup. I think it's the first game Rangers have lost this season. Not good for them, because for all the good work that Steven Gerrard has done there, this was a big opportunity for him to win his first trophy, and that's gone now. And I noticed also on Twitter that some St Mirren fan promised one of the players he'd get a tattoo of him on his leg if St Mirren won the game, and the player has now called him out and said, right, you have to get that. So I apologise to Rangers or St Mirren fans, but I was not even aware that game was being played last night. It is difficult with these midweek rounds of fixtures to watch practically an entire Premier League schedule and all the Scottish games in the space of two nights, one of which I was sent to work on the darts. So apologies for that.
Well, I have the tweet from Andrew Lupton. He's written it in phonetic Scottish, which is good of him. I'll get Jamie McGrath, 17, tattooed on my arse if we put them oot. Yeah. So there we are. Oot, OOT, he wrote. So yeah, well, we'll follow that, obviously. In slightly more sobering news, on Tuesday night, Cambridge United beat Colchester 2-1. I watched it on iFollow on silent, so I didn't hear any of this. But some of the Cambridge fans booed the taking of the knee. The chief executive of Cambridge, Ian Mather, said, "I feel incredibly frustrated, angry. There were only a few people booing, but one was too many. We worked really hard to get these fans in." A statement from the club released yesterday explained that those who booed last night will be identified and face a ban. He said, "The message to our fans is that behaviour is totally unacceptable and we don't want it here. We don't want anything like that here." So it's pretty depressing.
It is nice to see football clubs throwing these bozos out. It is heartwarming to see. But once again, these people, you can't change their minds. I saw you being taken to task on Twitter yesterday trying to reason with people, and you cannot reason with them. So get rid of them.
I didn't hear it, and I woke up yesterday with a lot of people telling me that I was a hypocrite because I'd been vocal about the Millwall fans. But while the Cambridge game was happening, what I could hear was Vera season 2, which was on my telly. It was a little bit harsh to call me out before I'd even seen it. But yeah, look, I have tried, and I tried it on the radio yesterday. And
Max, you're supposed to know everything and see and watch everything.
I was watching St Mirren Rangers, even though that was the following day, unlike our Fit Bar correspondent. But yeah, I totally agree with you, Barry. It is good that, and the Cambridge manager came out and called it out as well. and yeah, I hope they are dealt with. Carrie says, "Not so much a question as a request. After Philippe has explained in gruesome detail how Ligue 1 is in financial meltdown, can you spend a minute or two talking about how entertaining this season of Ligue 1 has been?" Philippe, do a minute on each, 30 seconds on each.
I don't think it's possible to talk about how entertaining it has been, because it hasn't been really that
fine. Let's go on to the TV stuff, because the TV stuff is fascinating, isn't it? It's
the TV stuff
totally
is fascinating.
Mad it's a situation, isn't it?
It's a cliff edge situation where we have basically somebody. And I have to say, some of us wrote about it at the time when MediaPro got those rights, promising all this huge amount of money, over €1 billion, that we didn't think that they had the means to do this. And people knew and were talking openly about it. And guess what happened? Well, they haven't got the money. And they now owe, I think, €324 million to the league. Okay? They're closing down the channel, which is showing the games. With the loss of about 180 jobs, including 60 of our journalist colleagues covering games. That's going to go. They're going to carry on showing the games. To be honest, who is going to pay for what? Nobody quite knows what's going on. The money is hemorrhaging. The game. This was the contract, the MediaPro contract, which was supposed to usher Ligue 1 into a new age. What they did is that they chose the wrong horse. They backed the wrong horse from the start. Honestly, it's a really, really worrying situation, Max. And an awful lot of people are going to go bankrupt. French football is going through probably its worst ever crisis, honestly, since professionalism was reinstated in 1946. That's how bad it is.
Philly, could I just ask a quick question? I used to work as an analyst in French football, so I've got a real fondness for the league. Is there any prospect of a government bailout or something like that? Does that not really happen in France?
There has been already, because of the pandemic, there's already been a plan which has been put in place, mostly in the form of interest-free loans and also things like tax rebates and things like that. So there's already been a first... But the amount of money we're talking about... Jonathan, how could you justify... bailing out an industry which has committed seppuku or harakiri, whichever way you want to put it. People had been warning about the Mediapro situation. Mm. They had been warning about it. It was pie in the sky. It doesn't exist. And French football made a choice that it is paying for at the moment, as it is also paying for the supremacy of PSG. So it's a question. We're in a really, really, really bad way.
I mean, one of the maddest things about that, I spoke to Tarek Pandra about this yesterday, was that they spent all that money on the rights to the football, but they didn't have package one. So each weekend, the biggest game is on Canal Plus. And yeah, in France, that means you don't get PSG or Marseille every week. So
that's crazy.
Total insanity for spending that amount of money. Does it mean lots of French clubs might go out of business? And does it mean in a more brutal way, there'll be lots of players who'll be available for not much money in January?
I think both are possibilities. There's a possibility of a bailout, of course. But the fact is that Mediapro, their business model was based on an ambition to garner as many as 5 million subscribers. It seems they've only gone 400,000, right? That's not rocket science.
Jonathan, can we ask you in your role as a scout and a football analyst just how that has been going in this sort of last few months since we last spoke to you?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest issue, and it also sort of follows on from Philippe's point, and you know, the situation in France is around Brexit, and you know, the new rules that have been put in place. There's a real strange situation at the moment there, simply because of the new rules that have come in. I'm not sure if you've seen it, but basically the FA have announced new rules which will come into effect from January. To summarize it in a bit of a nutshell, it's a bit strange because you would think that Brexit means kind of essentially limiting the amount of foreign players or sort of foreign players in English football. But essentially, really, what we're going to find is a situation where it's almost like shaking up a snow globe in terms of who can actually play in England going forward and who can't. They've introduced this new tier system, essentially, for qualification. It changes, really, what it does is it changes the criteria for players to be allowed to play in England. So whilst there's the likes of Cesc Fabregas, obviously they've put a ban now on signing players under 18. That no longer applies. Obviously, the old EU rule was that you could sign players from other countries from the age of 16. And that meant that academy recruitment, you had players like Hector Bellerin, Cesc Fabregas, a lot of players like that coming through from you know, European academies. That's going to be changed or at least tweaked and outlawed. But what it means is that the criteria system essentially means that we're going to see a lot of players coming in for the Championship and below for the Football League. Recruiting from Europe now essentially is going to end. If you look at players like, for example, Antti Knockaert, maybe Riyad Mahrez when he was at Leicester, Bruno at Brighton, who's obviously a very famous player there, Brian Mbeumo at Brentford, for example, at this moment in time, players like that will probably no longer qualify under this tier system. They won't have enough points because of the league they come from. For example, Ligue 2 or leagues like that, they have a lower ranking now. Whereas, strangely enough, teams in Turkey, for example, or teams in South America, the Copa Libertadores, they get more points now for their leagues or for their cup competitions. So I think in summary, what we're going to see is probably a lot more recruitment, maybe from South America. There's going to be more potential for those kind of players to now come to England. So whilst you would think Brexit means kind of a limitation on foreign players, actually it just means a shaking up, you know, of how things are going to be done going forward. So at this moment in time, for people working in recruitment, people working in scouting, it's really going to be a complete sea change of how everything is done.
Who knew? I was always told that Brexit would make things much less complicated anyway. Who knew? Can we just say well done before we end to Sturminster Rovers? They play in Dorset, not entirely sure what level of the pyramid. With 25 minutes to go, they were 8-1 down to Donhead Barbarians. And they drew 8-all with 7 late goals. George Coleman got 4 of them, adding to Kev Griffin, Billy Bright, Jay DeNorris and Josh Guppy. So well done. That's a great big 8-1 up and not holding on with 25 minutes left. That is a disappointing team talk on the side of the pitch, especially if you can't go in the changing rooms. Oh, that would be devastating. anyway, that'll do for today. Jonathan, thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot, Max. Nice to see you guys.
Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
Thanks, lads.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.